From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, did the Anunnaki create us? Michael Tellinger joins us. Looking forward to that. But here's what's happening. Well, you can expect sometime tomorrow, maybe the next day, some disruption with radio waves, maybe your cell phone, who knows what. New sunspot AR-1598 has erupted again. Earth orbiting satellites are detecting now a very strong X-class one. Thank God it's only a one, but it is an X-class. It's a solar flare, so that means some disruption. You can expect that. Earthquake experts around the world say they are appalled by an Italian court's decision to convict six scientists on manslaughter charges for failing to predict the deadly quake that devastated a city in Italy. They warn the ruling would severely harm future scientific research. Geologist Jim Berkland, he himself was suspended from a California government geology job because he made a prediction that came true. The major earthquake that occurred during the 1989 World Series in the Oakland Bay Area. Jim, first of all, I want to get your reaction to this Italian story. This is bizarre, isn't it?
Appalled is the word. I've been following this now for 3 years and had no idea that they would be so stupid in the court to come down on this. The scientific people that, you know, they kept saying that no one can actually predict a quake, and the swarm of quakes we've had often is not accompanied by a larger quake. And so even though they didn't predict one, they just said they were uncertain what it might mean. And that's, you cannot put people in prison for manslaughter with the lack of knowledge they had there. There were some questions about the radon gas that a full scientist discovered a series of water wells were emitting a lot of radon gas, which has often been used in the past by Russia and China to predict upcoming quakes. They said the radon release increases right before larger quakes. So this one young fellow began to warn people that around L'Aquila in Italy that the radon gas was really excessive, and he went to public meetings and things, and he was told to shut up. That,
unbelievable. Jim, when you made that prediction in 1989, you were chastised for that. Why did they go after you?
For a week, it was fine. Everybody was accepting it. Then the government leaders, mainly, since they had never been able to predict a quake, they came down on me for supposedly creating alarm, even though I'd hit exactly right. My prediction was 6.5 to 7 within a week at the time of the World Series, and I named it the World Series quake in the newspaper 4 days before it happened. And then 1 week later, I was called into the boss's office, and Jim said, or they said, well, we're concerned about your latest pronouncements. And they suspended me for over 2.5 months, and they really wanted to fire me.
Jeez, well, talking about
all my retirement benefits and everything.
Talking about predictions, I will not have you put in jail, but tell me, what do you see over the next few months, Jim?
Well, there are some big things coming, I'm afraid. Now, the window just closed yesterday, between the 15th and 22nd, and on the 20th, we had a 5.3 just south of Hollister in my predicted area, and I said it would be a 3.5 to 6, and so 5.3 in the predicted area and the time were exactly right.
You're always right, Jim. Jim Berkland, you can follow him. His website is on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. If you would, simply go to coasttocoastam.com. It's up there in the far right-hand corner, and just do so. Apple will begin to sell an 8-inch version of the iPad on Friday to compete with the smaller tablets, including Amazon.com's Kindle, but set a higher-than-expected price tag of $329 that Wall Street fears could curb demand. Talking about Wall Street, a sell-off on Wall Street gained momentum, stocks dropping 220 points after 3 Dow components issued disappointing earnings. Who watches those for us? None other than investment advisor Miss Shedlock. Miss, what do you think about this one? That's not that big, is it? 220 points?
No, and in light of the rally that we've seen over the past couple of years, this is nothing. However, there's a lot of stuff brewing out there, George. We've got a fiscal cliff brewing. Now, bear in mind, actually, I think that we either need to cut spending or raise taxes, one of the two, or otherwise we're going to have a problem down the road. The problem is no one wants to do anything about it now, which is always the standard case. 2 days ago, a Japanese official threatened a currency war because the yen was too high. Listen to this. He said Japan is falling behind on monetary stimulus. So now we've got other governments competing with the silliness that Bernanke's doing. You've got Romney threatening a currency war with China. Regardless of who wins the election, we've got a threat of a real war in Iran. You've got separatist movements in Spain, and the Spanish military is actually threatening military intervention in Spanish regions. We got the rise of the neo-Nazis in Greece. But this earnings story, everyone's talking about the big misses at IBM, Intel, Google, and today it was UPS, and a couple days ago was CAT. But the one that caught my eye the most actually is one that was the least talked about, and that's McDonald's. You know, their same store sales are plunging. Now we're talking about fast food.
Yeah.
This is something that I've commented on to you before, and I'll just leave you with this one thought. How many more Pizza Huts, McDonald's, nail salons, Walmarts do we need? And if we don't need that many, George, where are we going to get our jobs from?
Good point, Mitch. And you circle election night in November. I'd like you on the show to pop in and give us your analysis for a bit, okay?
Oh, would love to do that, George.
All right, Mitch. See you then. It's coming up. It's only a few weeks away. Exercising in your 70s may stop your brain from shrinking and slowing the signs of aging linked to dementia. Brain scans of 638 people past the age of retirement show that those who were the most physically active had less brain shrinkage over a three-year period. So remember to do that as you get up in age. The United States Food Safety Inspection Service has announced 2,300 pounds of ground beef products from Utah and 4,000 pounds of ground beef products from Hawaii are being recalled on fears that they may be contaminated with E. coli. Our food safety expert, Jeff Nelkin, with us. Well, here we go again, Jeff. Contamination, poor hygiene, who knows what, huh?
Let's mention to our friends in Hawaii, where it first kicked off, if they have any questions or any doubts, the vice president, his name is Sheldon Wright. His number is 808-531-3591. So if you have any product and you're not sure, about it, please contact them. But for now, let's make sure that we do cook our ground beef to at least 160 degrees. Let's use thermometers and, let's get away from just touching the meat or looking at it and judging and trying to say, hey, there's no blood coming out, because that's not necessarily the case. You've got to use a thermometer to show you that you've reached that 160 degrees so that meat is safe. The symptoms, again, from the E. coli that we talked about, could be anywhere from cramping, bloody diarrhea. Usually it takes about 2 to 4 days for the symptoms to show. And overall, let's make sure that we wash our hands before we start handling any of the meat. And if we have anybody in the family that is high risk, in other words, under the age of 5 or over the age of 65, let's take all precautions and wash our hands, especially before, if we've been touching animals, and then go into handling food preparation.
Very good, Jeff. Always welcome your advice. I really do. Speaking of animals, by the way, to coax her two daughters to sleep, a British housewife, Marina Chapman, would tell them bedtime stories about growing up in the jungle. But they were not fairy tales. They were based on her own life. At the age of 5, Chapman, who then lived in Colombia, was reportedly kidnapped and abandoned in the jungle, left for dead. She managed to join a tribe of monkeys, copying what they ate and drank, their social activities, even their language, until she was part of that family, which she stayed with for 5 years. She's chronicled her extraordinary tale in a book called The Girl with No Name. That would be fascinating. And they talked about other cases where children were raised by goats, by wild cats, by dogs, by wolves. It's an incredible story. I want to do a whole show on that. Children raised by animals. It's just amazing. Up next, Sir Charles Schulz III joins us shiny objects on Mars and other strange things going on in the universe? He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Charles Schulz III. Worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for a number of years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing II missile system as well. He's been on Coast to Coast numerous times. Noted author, The Living Galaxy, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. Tonight we're going to talk about things going on in space and science and just have some fun this hour with Sir Charles Schulz III. Charles, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. It's always a lot of fun.
So the Curiosity doing its thing on Mars, I think it's a great accomplishment. Spotted some very tiny, shiny objects on Mars.
Yes.
What the heck are they?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago they found some objects, and it turned out to be the thing they found was a piece of plastic off the rover. This time, they've got something completely different, and they found that these are particles of Mars itself, something found under the surface of the soil. Now, they're still not sure what it is, and they think that it may be a water-created mineral. It's a small, shiny object, not much larger than, let's say, a grain of rice. They found a couple of these pieces, and they scooped them up and put them in the chemistry and mineralogy analyzer. So they're going to use X-rays to examine them and see what elements they're made of. And John Grotzinger, the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, is Curiosity's chief mission scientist, and he says this is a milestone because this is going to be the first time they analyze anything with the ChemMin device. Now, they have 10 different instruments on the rover, and this is one of them they're going to be using. If they find out that it's full of something such as silica, it may be opal or a mineral crystal. If it's something like calcium carbonate, it might be a fragment of a seashell or a fossil. If it's gypsum, it could be calcite or some marine sediment. So they're not really certain what it is yet, but they have it in the mineral analyzer, and they're having a look at it as we speak.
If it was made by extraterrestrials, who knows whom, would this machine, Curiosity, be able to analyze that and say that?
Well, it could tell you what it was made of, but it couldn't tell you what the source is. Most of the time when we do something along these lines, we discover the minerals and we then look at the environment and say what sort of conditions existed to put it there. We couldn't tell if somebody had made it unless it was some really outstanding signature.
So, you know, let's say they found a pencil. They'd be able to say, you know, this is this analysis of wood and graphite and this and that, but we might not know that it was a made pencil, right?
Well, you know, if you found something such as wood, for instance, it would be pretty obvious it was an organic material because of the carbon it would contain
along with
hydrogen and oxygen. So you could see what elements were in it, but you couldn't tell that it was specifically wood. If you had a piece of plastic, a piece of wood, or some other similar materials, a piece of meat, they all might analyze very closely in structure because of their similarity of chemistry. So that would be difficult to say.
What is Sir Charles working on these days?
Oh, I'm sticking with my energy research and staying kind of quiet, working on big things.
you've got some information for us because you're really interested in this discovery of an exoplanet. Tell me about this one.
Oh, indeed. You know, the nearest solar system to us, Alpha Centauri, has been discovered to have a planet orbiting the B star. Now, this is a very exotic solar system. It has a pair of stars orbiting each other. So for many of the worlds there would never be a night time to speak of. This planet that they have found is about 4.2 light years away, and it's orbiting the B star of Alpha Centauri, and it is so close that it orbits that star in 3.3 days. This is a planet slightly larger than the Earth, from what they can tell, but the surface temperature would be over 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit, making it a planet basically of molten lava. But it's an exciting find because the finding of planets so close to us, particularly rocky worlds, means that we have a good chance of discovering other more Earth-like worlds along the way. So this is, I believe, the 843rd exoplanet we found so far, but it's the closest one to our solar system, which is really exciting.
You do know, Charles, I think eventually they will know that, and they've done this with mathematical projections, that there are probably billions of planets out there.
Oh, there's no question about it. So far, the indications we've seen is that there literally could be over a trillion planets in this galaxy alone.
Would you be surprised with that estimate that there's no life on any of them?
That would be absolutely overwhelming. The universe is so large. Chemistry is so common. Everything tells us that there has to be life all over the galaxy, all over the universe. So that would be a truly overwhelming discovery.
Next hour, I talk with a guest who has a theory about how life started here, intelligent life, how it may have been seeded by other extraterrestrials. Does not negate the belief in a God, because eventually somebody had to create who they were, and it goes all the way down the line. What about intelligent life, Charles? Okay, so maybe on these billions of planets, we're going to find organisms and trees and shrubbery and maybe some fish. But what about intelligent life like us? I find it hard to believe we're alone in the universe.
Well, I don't think very many people think that we are alone in the universe. Life itself always strives for complexity. It solves problems, and it becomes more complex along the way. And intelligence is one of the tools, just like claws or scales or poison, that organisms use to protect themselves. It increases their ability to survive. So intelligence is an inevitable thing given time and the proper conditions. I would imagine that there could be tens of thousands of civilizations in our galaxy right now, but a lot of them would probably be non-technical, just as we've been for many tens of thousands of years. And so when you think about it, there could be whole civilizations on the order of people living in the plains or hunting and gathering, and we wouldn't hear anything from them. We'd only be able to see them if we actually went there.
Because the primordial soup is probably the same everywhere, is it conceivable then that this intelligent life probably looks like us? We'll have two ears, a nose, a couple eyes, a mouth?
You know, that's very hard to say. On our planet, that plan works very well, and we would expect that on many worlds that would be true, because it's a very simple and very robust solution to the problem of being an organism that is successful. But, you know, there's so much diversity on this world alone. When we think about living forms on other worlds, we can think of almost anything that might have a brain. Consider the difference between human beings and dolphins, and how smart a dolphin is.
If a dolphin had a thumb, God knows what they could be doing, right?
Well, yes, but you know, there's an interesting thought there, and this has been considered. There may be many, many worlds with dolphin-like creatures just as smart as us, but without thumbs, and one other problem that they would have to face. Technology is very difficult if you live under the water. You can't create fire, you can't make ceramics, you can't do electricity or chemistry in many ways. So it would present a new whole set of problems that might be rather insurmountable. A civilization of dolphins might be very highly advanced, but be unable to do a lot of the technical things that we do because we can get out on the land and use fire.
I ran a piece of audio last night, Charles, of a whale that they recorded baffling scientists because it actually sounds like a human being. I mean, it's got the sounds and the moaning sounds of a human being. It's incredible.
Well, it is, and you know, it's amazing how different the hardware of the throat and the vocal apparatus can be among animals and still produce astounding sounds. The whale discovery is surprising, and it is very interesting, but consider how a parrot or other similar birds can make sounds that sound exactly like a person, and they're not using anything similar to our mouth, throat, or lips. They're very, very different.
Anything new in the world of the fossils on Mars that you've investigated over the years?
We found a number of new and interesting things. We're keeping our eyes open right now and putting together some new material to present. I have not found anything truly outstanding just yet, and I'm waiting to see what the analysis of the bright particles is going to tell us. But, you know, that also reminds me, I'm always concerned about this fossil issue and what it implies for a sample return. And that leads us to the thought that this is really a bad idea, and I can't say enough to warn people that if they do bring samples back, we could face a real crisis. We have enough problems that it is with diseases on the world right now, and to have something we have no immunity to would be a terrible, terrible flaw. Which also leads me to something else I wanted to talk about. You know, cholera has been a real problem all over the world, particularly in disaster areas. And some researchers at Simon Fraser University just discovered what makes cholera so deadly, and in turn discovered how to use it to kill cholera and other diseases. Now, this is a fascinating discovery. Cholera is a very simple organism, and it's covered with string-like proteins, and it actually grabs hold of viruses, pulls it into the cell, and hijacks their genes so it becomes toxic. Well, these researchers have found that they can take antibodies, coat them with similar proteins, and the cholera will draw the antibodies or antibiotics right into their own cells and kill them.
Amazing.
So
amazing.
They now have a new way of targeting antibiotics for cholera and other bugs such as the ones that give people with cystic fibrosis respiratory infections, and now they have a new way of treating that.
They could never do that before. I want to talk with you about quantum teleportation, Charles, when we come back. Plus, we'll take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this hour, we're going to take your phone calls with Sir Charles Schulz as we talk about things in space. Next hour, Michael Tellinger joins us. We'll talk about his thoughts about the Anunnaki. Hey, by the way, if you are thinking about becoming a Coast Insider, a member of this exclusive club, do so now. Get it as a gift. Get it for yourself. A lot of people are signing up for it, and I'm very proud of this. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. You'll find out how you can download podcasts and do all these other great things for about 15 cents a day. Coast Insider at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back, and if you're just scanning the dial on your radio and you've stumbled into us, you're listening to Coast AM, the world's highest-rated late-night talk show. Sir Charles Schulz with us this hour. Charles, before we take calls, give me your thoughts on quantum teleportation, moving solid objects. How real is this?
Well, it's becoming more real by the moment. You know, just a couple of months ago, they were able to teleport a photon 89 miles, roughly, and that's just a particle of light. But the problem is they only send particles without mass. But the discovery of the Higgs vector boson, the Higgs particle, last July, actually changes the equation a bit. The Higgs boson is what apparently gives matter its mass. If we could find a way now to decouple the Higgs boson field from regular matter, it would become massless and capable of being teleported just like the photons. So the work they're doing presently shows that if we could use this method, we possibly could send solid objects. Now, this is very interesting because right now the big push in quantum teleportation is for communication. They're setting up communication links on the ground because of their security and the inability to be cracked and to send information privately, and they're soon planning on setting them up with satellites to send information from point to point. But using quantum methods could lead to a method of teleporting things and also a method of computing using quantum computing that would be trillions of times more powerful than the most powerful computer we have today. So the three fields, teleporting, computation, and communication, are all tied deeply together with quantum mechanics these days.
That's exciting, isn't it?
It's fantastic because it means something could be sent from one point to another without having to cross the intervening distance. And the question does remain. Right now, everything we send from one point to another travels at whatever speed we can send it, and information is limited by the speed of light. But one of the things that we found with quantum mechanics is spooky action at a distance, as it was called by Albert Einstein. When particles are entangled, their destinies tied together through quantum mechanical means, the change in one can be reflected instantaneously by the other, no matter where it is in the universe. So this could lead to a method of sending information and things faster than light. Who knows?
When Gene Roddenberry invented Star Trek, how close did he come to reality when he did his teleportation and things like that?
Well, his description of the transporter in the show probably is unrealistic in a number of ways, but consider that when he did this in the early 1960s, it was actually meant as a means to prevent having to put a spacecraft on every time they went down to the planet. And so his reasoning was, let's have something that works instantaneously, and he came up with his transporter idea. Yet we're finding the tip of the iceberg for the sort of technology that could provide us with that ability now.
Well, it's going to be remarkable. Remember The Fly, the movie The Fly, and that little fly got stuck in there with him?
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, of course, in reality, that sort of thing is very, very unlikely. But I'm sure we're going to find some people who will find ways of changing matter in the process of transmitting from one point to another. And we could end up with something very similar to the replicator on Star Trek.
I think so, too. Charles, let's take some calls here for you in the short time that we have remaining. Let's go to Long Beach, California. Grant's with us on Coast to Coast. Grant, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, Grant.
Great.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you think it's a possibility on these planets that could have, like, some kind of worms in the bottom layers of this lava?
Well,
it's possible. What do you think, Charles?
You know, we haven't found anything that lives in temperatures much more than the boiling point of water. And the only places we find things that live even under those extremes are the very bottom of the ocean, where the temperatures for water boiling point can be much higher because of the pressure.
That's right.
Molten lava, That would have to be a completely different sort of chemistry from any of the life we know of. So I can't say no and I can't say yes. I think that it's unlikely, however.
Would you be surprised, Charles, if there were worms living in the soil on Mars?
Not in the least, but the energy that they have. In our atmosphere, we have a lot of oxygen, and so there's plenty of energy for organisms such as animals. But on the soil of Mars, the conditions would be very close to vacuum. The very air is so thin that under many circumstances, water does boil easily, but there isn't any oxygen. Now, we have discovered oxygen-free animals on the Earth, so it isn't outside the realm of possibility.
Next up, it's Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, Sir Charles. Hi, I'm an amateur astronomer, and I know a lot about space and astronomy since I was a small boy. I'll get right to my two quick questions. They're both on life in our solar system in two different areas. Question number one has to do with the other chemistry experiment you did not talk about on the rover Curiosity, SAM, the sample analysis on Mars. And my second question will deal with two moons in the outer solar system, Europa, the moon of Jupiter, as well as Enceladus, the moon of Saturn. So question number one, when do you think will the sample analysis of Mars, the SAM experiment, hopefully detect organic molecules, specifically carbon, more specifically methane, the kind of methane that could be produced only by biological activity, meaning life, as opposed to geological activity? And with this question number one also is will that come out hopefully before the election, so it could be a great October surprise to help President Obama win re-election, who I hope he does win re-election. Question number two, on the outer moons, Europa and Enceladus, when do you think it will be when the United States or our whole world will send an unmanned mission or missions to both Europa and or Enceladus to drill underneath the ice of both of those worlds or melt something really hot deep into the ice to look for life underneath the ice in the oceans that undoubtedly are inside Europa and Enceladus?
Okay, so the SAM question. We'd have to talk to the project manager to see when the SAM is going to be deployed. And the detection of methane itself doesn't necessarily show you whether it's from geology or from biology. The methane molecule is identical in both cases, so you'd have to locate the specific source. But they have found carbonate dust all over the planet, so there is carbon present. As far as Europa and Enceladus, Europa, you know, does have an ocean inside from what they can see, but the color of its surface matches a spectrum of bacterial growth found on Earth. So there are some hints that there may be life inside the ice there. And Enceladus, as you know, does spout liquid water and organic molecules, and they've been very excited about that as well. Getting a mission there would be a years-long process, probably 5 to 7 to 10 years, depending on how it's done. And sending a vehicle that could melt through the ice would be an expensive and complex process, but it could be done, and research is being done presently on those systems. So some of the work done on Lake Vostok in Antarctica to drill deeply into that hidden lake that's been sealed for millions of years is being developed specifically for this sort of a mission. So it's something that would take at least, I would estimate, 7 to 10 years to happen.
Well, that could be, absolutely. And, you know, we went to Titan. Right? We took some great pictures there. We found out about the methane. Why don't we try to land on those kind of places?
Well, they did land. The Kuiper spacecraft landed on Titan, and it sent back pictures from the surface, and it even recorded the sound of the atmosphere as it landed. And they discovered that there are, in fact, liquids and geology processes happening on Titan, even though it's 289 below centigrade there. Very, very cold. Water is literally a mineral on that moon. But you see, the cost of sending a craft is the problem, and the design phase, the testing phase, those things take a great deal of time. They are trying to come up with some pretty standardized methods of doing it, and we do have a lot of hardware to draw on. But again, you know, launching the hardware, we don't have a lot of launch capability in this country right now, but it is improving. The situation is getting better, and I expect within the next 5 years, we're going to see some very low-cost methods of getting spacecraft out of the outer planets.
When we went to Titan, Charles, was it because it was so Earth-like? Is that why we went?
No, not at all. It's because it's an enigma. Almost all of the moons of any of the outer planets are very, much larger than other moons in our solar system. However, they have very little gravity, and Titan is an anomaly because it has such a thick atmosphere, about 1.5 times the atmosphere pressure we have on Earth. But it is loaded with organic molecules, and that they could tell from long ago. It's absolutely loaded with methane and ethane. It's basically in a petroleum smog all the time. So it was a fascinating place because they suspected that the liquid phase of methane could exist there, and they were able to prove that. That was the first time they could get images through the clouds down at the surface of the moon itself.
Well, let's go to first-time caller Dimitri, truck driving in Kansas. Dimitri, go ahead.
I had a theory that not long ago I was listening to radio, and something came across my mind. Say, like, the currents exist all over. Let's begin with Fibonacci. Like, everything repeats itself, starting from small to bigger. Well, I kind of apply that same concept to different disciplines. Say, like, we have currents on Earth and veins and arteries in organisms, and say the whole realm of space, like the cosmos, is also like ecosystem. And say there is currents in the cosmos that we are unable to see because they're too fast to visualize the cameras. Perhaps maybe the NASA or the, you know, space.
Well, is that what dark matter is? Is Dimitri onto something here, Charles?
Well, actually, no. There are currents in dark matter from what we can tell because the material seems to be moving around in all directions. But in the subject of current, we actually can see that there are dust and gas currents and magnetic field currents moving through space in all directions. There may be 7 or 8 different types of, think of them as overlaying maps of different types of current based on different types of energy, different types of particles. And some of those we are seeing right now. One is the current of solar wind leaving the sun and pushing the bubble out in the interstellar void around us right now. Our Pioneer spacecraft and the Voyagers have reached the edge of that bubble, and they're sending back information about it now. So there are currents of all sorts all throughout the galaxy, and we're just beginning to become capable of sensing them and sending the information back.
What would be, to date, the most baffling thing in the universe that you would like to get an answer for? Wormholes? What might it be?
I think that the wormhole is a very good answer, question to confront. Can we make a wormhole on demand, and can we make it stable enough to get information or energy or matter through? That would solve a lot of very interesting problems, such as transporting things from point to point. And it would also give us the possibility of opening a gateway in time, because if one wormhole stays at home and the other travels in a fast spaceship or near the speed of light in a linear accelerator, it would act like a time doorway from one to the other.
Good point. Let's go to Racine, Wisconsin. Hey, Tim, good morning. You're up with Charles Schultz.
Hi, Charles, and hi, George. Hi.
Hello, Timmy.
How are you doing today? Or this morning, I should say, for me. So, yeah, I have a question. Like on Mars now, if they did find, say they find matter, you know, that would constitute life. And I don't know really constitutes life on another planet. So I'm not from another planet. I'm only, but it's like, is silicon, like you were talking, is that what you said, silicon?
Sure.
Oh, yeah, okay. Now, do you think if they do find this, would they hold that information from us? And also, I mean, George, I got a question for you, too. What happened to that chasing UFO show? And I'll hang up and hear your answers. Thanks.
Okay.
Right, you go first, Charles.
Okay, very good. Well, they found all sorts of atoms on Mars, all sorts of matter. And if they were to discover that they had life on their hands, I don't know if they would say anything or if they would hold it to a point when they can use it as leverage or for some advantage. It's difficult to say. It's kind of inscrutable when you hear what some of the organizations in our government do. So I really couldn't speak for them. I know that I feel that they have found very strong evidence of life, and the things that I presented, I think, are a very strong case to support that. But will they say anything? It's utterly impossible for me to say.
Chasing UFOs, by the way, got chased off the air because the numbers weren't good. It was a bottom line thing. You either have good ratings or you don't, and if you don't, you get booted off the air. One of the problems with these kinds of reality shows that it's not like you can conjure up a UFO at will, and some of the hype that was tied to that show, I think, caught up with them. You've seen a lot of these reality-type shows, Charles. I mean, it's, you know, like these ghost shows where they always seem to find a ghost or something like that happens. And that's just not the case in reality.
Well, you know, I have to admit, I don't really watch television. I haven't seen any of the reality shows, but I can imagine that unless you had a UFO airline flight schedule, you really wouldn't know where to look and what to look for.
Well, that's a good point. Ray is in Ripon, California. Hey, Ray, let's get you in here. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm the second time caller. Remember, I'm the one with the cootie bug?
The cootie bug, that's right.
Right, that's me. Anyway, my in-laws, they worked at a government place in Fullerton in 1967, and we were watching Star Trek one day, and one night, and they had a teleporter, and they beamed Scotty up and Scotty down. Anyway, I said, "Isn't that amazing?" She said, "They already have that. They've been experimenting with that, beaming an object from one end of the room to the other." That's Northrop. Northrop is what they work, who they work for. And they beamed an object from one end of the room to another. And that was in 67. So they've been doing that teleporting thing for a lot of years already.
Well, that's probably true, Charles. What do you think?
I suppose it's possible, but, you know, something like that, you would feel that some information would end up in the physics journals, some fallout technology would arise from it, and I don't see any evidence of that. It's not beyond the realm of possibility.
Hollywood, we go. Brian, take it away. We'll squeeze you in. Go ahead. Hollywood, Florida.
Hey, how are you, Sir Charles? I love this show. I got a question. I love you and I admire you, but what's to say that the Illuminati, or what's to say that the big guys is not hiring you to tell us the information to keep us limited, and at the same time they're advancing and they keep you guys keeping us under, so we won't know the real truth. What's to say that you aren't working with Illuminati?
Well, that's always a fair enough question, Charles. Are you a disinformation expert?
Absolutely not, and I don't have the paychecks to prove it.
And I can assure you, Charles is the real deal and a great researcher. And were you always interested in science, even when you were a little boy?
I have always, throughout my life, been interested in science. I started out when I was 5 years old collecting rocks. Moved from there to electronics and chemistry and astronomy, and I just tore it up. Everything there was, I wanted to know, and it's been something lifelong. It's given me the greatest excitement and satisfaction, because every time you learn something, you have another tool in your arsenal. You know, you have another means of answering a question and another skill you can put your hands to work with.
Charles, I'm the kind of guy, I love things that happen in space. I've always been an astronomy buff, but I love alternative medicine and, you know, new techniques and just investigations. How about you? What are some of your favorite things?
Well, you know, I do a lot of things non-scientific as well. I've long been an astronomy buff, but I also enjoy simple things like cooking and playing the piano and diving and just really having fun with life. We're here to enjoy our lives. And, you know, I'll tell you something. One thing I've discovered, I would love to see everybody in the world have everything they need and a little bit more. I mean, that's what I work for. I want to see a world where everybody's happy.
Good for you. I cook because, to me, it's like chemistry. And years ago, I got my PADI scuba diver certification.
Fantastic.
And it's a great thing. Charles, always a pleasure to have you on the program, Sir Charles Schultz. His website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, we're going live, way live out there to the United Kingdom to talk about the Anunnaki. Did they see us? Let's find out with another theory.